Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, Richard and I were talking about some of the beautiful music that we have been privileged to bring on this channel. But I don't know if this isn't my favorite, Richard. Absolutely beautiful. This is a Quarteto Latin Americano. And I have with us Saul Bitran to talk to us about it, who's the violinist. He's the first violinist. The quartet is obviously four, and three of the four are brothers. Now, the quartet was founded in 1982. So one of the questions that I am going to ask for sure is, I can't get along with my sister for a weekend sometimes. I mean, 1982 is a long time. Anyway, let me introduce you to Saul, and then I've got a bunch of questions for Saul, who's going to be with us for the first half hour of our show today. Saul is an associate professor of violin at Boston Conservatory at Berkeley, and he's taught extensively. And I want to talk to him a little bit about his students. Not only has he taught extensively, but he's an award-winning violinist. And what really impressed me about his bio is that he has played under really notable conductors. Esa-Pekka Salonen, Jared Schwartz, Eduardo Mata, Keith Lockhart, many others. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because before I formally introduce Saul, I have to tell you a funny story about Richard. Maestro Dudamel came on the program, Saul, once. Richard's already laughing. He was doing a performance at the Granada, and I was so honored he agreed to come on and just talk with us for a little bit about the program. And Richard said, and Richard likes to go to classical music concerts, and so the symphony had laid aside some tickets for the Mahler that Maestro was going to play. Conduct, I should say. And Richard said, Maestro, I've always wanted to ask someone of your stature this question. Why don't you change the key for the Mahler? And I thought Maestro was going to fall off the stool. It was in the days when we didn't worry too much about being smooshed together in the studio. I thought Maestro was going to fall off the studio, off the stool. And he pulled himself together, and he's such a decorous person, so polite. And he pulled himself together, and I saw him go a little white, a little red, a little white in the face, etc. And he said, let me explain, Richard. And he said it this way, and I'll never tire of telling the story. He said, let's say you were at the Met, the Museum of Art, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Let's say you were at the Met, and you were in front of a Picasso. And you said, you know, geez, I think if we went back in time, I would ask Picasso, you see that orange that's the predominant color here, Pablo? I want that all yellow. That's what Maestro said to Richard. And he said, you know, it's how the keys in my mind are like the colors, Richard. And do you remember that, Richard?
I absolutely do, yes. That was so funny. But
it was great. But he explained it in such a beautiful way. And so I want to introduce Saul formally, based on the fact that he and the quartet are coming to perform for us November 10th at 2 p.m. And that is at Santa Barbara Museum of Art, Mary Craig Auditorium. Inexpensive tickets. If you're a member, it's $20. If you're non-member, it's $25. This is a beautiful Sunday afternoon. By the way, the quartet is the winner of the 2012 and 2016 Latin Grammys for Best Classical Recordings. They're doing their music. It was called Tribute to the Americas. And they're playing Hector Villa-Lobos. They're playing Gershwin. They're playing Piazzolla. They're playing Samuel Barber, Adagio for Strings. Wow. And they're playing Dvorak. So it'll be a fantastic afternoon. They're one of the world's most renowned classical music ensembles. For more than 30 years, the leading proponent of Latin American music for the string quartet. Like I said, they were founded in Mexico in 1982. They've toured Europe, North and South America, Israel, China, Japan, New Zealand. They premiered more than 100 works written for them, and they continue to introduce new and neglected composers to the genre. They are also recognized with the Mexican Music Critics Association Award and three times received Chamber Music America Most Adventurous Programming Award. And I would like to say also that Saul personally has received Mexico and Chile's highest artistic awards, namely the Bellas Arts Medal and the Order of Merit Pablo Neruda. So with that, I want to ask Saul the question we started with, which is what's the dynamics between the three brothers? And you've got three brothers and one non-brother. Does the one non-brother, in my mind, I was thinking about this, maybe the one non-brother is like the ringmaster, and he kind of, how does that work, Saul?
Well, first of all, thank you, Elizabeth, for an invitation, and thank you, Richard. I'm happy to be here talking with you. We're looking forward to our concert in Santa Barbara, November 10th. And as far as dynamics in the quartet, that's a mystery, and that's something for a string to talk about. I'm not an expert. I just do my job. We get along with the brothers. We get along with the non-brother. We have been functioning for a long time. I guess if you were to psychoanalyze me now, I don't think we have time for that. We tend to focus on the task at hand, on the work, and we put all personal side matters aside. And I don't know how we do it, but when we're rehearsing, I tend to forget that this other two guys sitting next to me are my brothers. But then at night, we may have a family dinner with my father, who is 96 here in Mexico City. And we have a great fun, and we talk about other things, never about the quartet. But this is all unconscious. So it's a very interesting dynamics, and it definitely merits not only a book about our quartet, but a book about and research about how string quartets work, because it's a very intense microcosm of human collaboration, democracy in full force, and the relations are really mysterious, because most quartets split not for musical reasons, because they don't get along, and we have been lucky enough to have gotten along and still get along after 42 years.
Yeah, so you know, watching some of the YouTube performances, and Richard's, by the way, he's edited all those into some music going in and out of the breaks that we're going to have today throughout the hour. So you will be listening to the Quartetto Latin Americano, and you will be hearing Saul Vitran as first violinist. I'm watching the YouTube videos, and I'm seeing very subtle indications between the four of you. And your first violin, so are you essentially kind of leading the nods and the small body movements? Are you leading the pack?
Just a little bit, but only with entrances, cues. Otherwise, when we're playing, we're a real functioning democracy, because in quartet music is written as such that everybody has equal importance. So we really don't have a leader, and that's probably the most significant difference between orchestra and chamber music. Orchestra is led by a conductor. We don't have a conductor. I was going to say thank God, but I better don't. Well, I said it anyway. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And so we are really listening to each other's opinions and trying out things and exercising this diversity of voices. And then at the end of the rehearsal, we come up with a version which includes opinions of all of us. And then in the concert, I become a leader, but just for gestures of when to come in, when to finish, things like that. But during the playing, we just listen to each other and adjust.
You know, in the press material, and this is something I wanted to ask you about, in the press material, it's you're quoted as saying, or the quartet is quoted as saying that, having said that, it seems a lot of the Latin American repertoire prominently features rhythm, or so we are told. And because you have for 42 years brought the Latin American repertoire to our attention, do you is it true? So we are told, but is it true that a central common denominator in Latin American music is rhythm?
I think so. Of course, there are all kinds of pieces written in Latin America. Some of them are slow, contemplative. Some of them sound totally European or could be written in Tokyo. But the core of the Latin American repertoire, which is probably the nationalist period between 1930 and 1960, 70, was very much inspired by folk music. And folk music in Latin America, as we know, is rhythmical because it has influences from Africa, from native cultures. All those cultures feature the percussion instruments as very, very central. So this music is composed with a strong rhythmic component. And so it happens that a lot of what we play is very strong on rhythm.
We have in this community, I don't know if anybody from Santa Barbara has told you this before, but in this community, we have a really strong organization called Nomad Tango, and they're a organization devoted to tango music of generations. And there's a music scholar that works with them. That's connected with the university here. They're really, really active, and they've brought some wonderful tango performers of all kinds, classical tango and very modern, new agey kind of almost like tango punk rock. There's a big group that follow tango here in town.
Well, I hope we come to the concert because we are playing a piece, original four quartet by Piazzolla, which is the only piece that Piazzolla wrote for a quartet. It's called Four for Tango.
That's why I'm about to bring that up. The Piazzolla that you're going to play, I'm going to put that out to the club there and make sure that they do come. I want to know more about your collaboration with Eduardo Mata, who is one of my favorite conductors. I want to know, you cite that you've actually collaborated, not only been directed but conducted under him, but that you have collaborated with him. In what way?
Well, he was a patron of the quartet. He was a good friend, and he heard us early on in our career. He heard a lot of potential. He connected us with a manager, with our recording company, Dorian Records. He really pushed us hard. He formed a little orchestra in Mexico called Solistas de México, and he was a conductor. So we were really close to him, and he died tragically in an aviation accident in 1995. But there is not a single day that I don't remember him and his unwavering support for us. He was really instrumental in our quartet's success.
Do you think that most quartets have such a mentorship?
I think so. If you look at the Guarneri Quartet, the Tokyo Quartet, these are people who worked in summer festivals in the U.S., in Meadowmont, in Marlboro, with the Budapest Quartet, with the old European quartets that came to the U.S., and they always mention those people as their mentors. I think it's difficult to launch a career without that help, not only as far as inspiration, but sometimes real practical matters, because a person who has credibility and is a well-known musician can speak with an agent, with a manager, with a recording company, and recommend. And without that, it's very difficult to make it out in there. There's so much competition otherwise.
You know, the foremost scholar, it's interesting, the foremost scholar that, so our university collected the archives because of the interest in tango. The foremost scholar who died in the, I think it was in the 60s or the 70s, collected archival recordings of all kinds of Latin American music. That was his area of research, and all of his archives have recently come to UCSB. but he was French. And I note with interest that you have connected, you have done a lot of performances that and recitals connecting French and Latin American music. I wondered, what's the common ground, or is it not common? Maybe they diverge. I see that so often.
Yes.
That scholars, you know, they're exchanging. But go ahead.
Well, as you probably know, and this is true for the American intellectuals and artists, at the beginning of the 20th century, Paris was the place to be. If you didn't spend time in Paris, you were not considered a serious artist, painter, theater person, musician, intellectual, writer, whatever. So Paris was the mecca for culture, and most of the important composers in Latin America went to Paris, spent time there, either with scholarships or just by themselves, like Villa-Lobos, and they absorb a lot of French culture, which permeates their music. So there is a live link between France and Latin American culture, and so is the case with American culture. I mean, jazz in France was a big deal, and then on the other hand, American composers, most of them studied in France with Nadia Boulanger, and so this is a very, very fruitful collaboration that happened between our two continents.
I also want to point out to our listeners that you are the concertmaster of Unitas Ensemble, which is a Boston-based orchestra committed to introduce Latin American repertoire to U.S. audiences. So that's an orchestra. And he's been a soloist. Saul's been a soloist with that orchestra. And under that auspice brought a concerto, the Two Seasons of the Caribbean Tropics. What's the connection with the Caribbean for you?
So this was a composer who just recently died, Paul Desen, French Venezuelan, and he was a fantastic creative composer. And he saw he took Vivaldi's Four Seasons as inspiration, but then he translated them to the crazy weather in the Caribbean area, especially in Venezuela, where you have these long dry spells where everything burns, and then you have 6 months of unrelenting rain and hurricanes. So he wrote a very interesting piece for violin and orchestra, with some quotation from Vivaldi, but also a lot of Latin and very complicated music, and a very, very interesting idea. And the music is terrific, and I recorded it, and it's on the platforms too.
So also there's a connection with France, also in the award, and I can't pronounce it. The award, is it Diapason d'Or that you won?
Yes, Diapason d'Or is the foremost French award. It's the equivalent of the Grammys in France. It's given to the best recordings of the year, and this is something we received, I think, in the year 2000 for a recording with it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay, so now I want to ask you about this phenomenon, and I'll just reference a little bit of my personal life here. My mom was the first female graduate. She's born in 1929. She's still around, like your dad, you know, about that age. And she was the first female graduate of Juilliard in conducting.
Oh, wow.
And and she was up till like 2-3 years ago, she played actively and performed actively on the piano. And absolute amazing woman. But one thing that bothered me extensively growing up was that I grew up in a kind of a farm community, wasn't real forward thinking as far as technology is concerned. And we had those alarm clocks that you had to wind. So it had a spring wind.
Yes.
And it would wake me up every morning, but I was, you know, I'm a teenager. I don't want to get out of bed. So it would go ring. And my mom had perfect pitch, and she would absolutely react with horror to this downward pulse of the sound. And this would bother her every morning. So my question is, the four of you, I know you're shaking your head. You know, you can hear it, right?
I absolutely empathize with that. I also have perfect pitch, and I know what a nightmare.
That was my question. Yes.
Yeah, so I was remember your anecdote with Ewan and Richards with Dudamel about the key of a piece. So sometimes I hear a recording of a piece I know very well, somehow the recording is distorted a little bit, lower in pitch or higher in pitch, and I need to turn the radio off. I just can't. If it's supposed to be in E major and it's sounding like almost E flat major, I can't listen. I get positively sick. I need to turn the radio off. Yeah.
Yep. 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 So to continue with the anecdote about my mom, it's a as she got older, she was a rehearsal pianist for the Lyric in Chicago for years. And so I always used to attend the sing-along, the Messiah sing-along with her. And she would, in her later years, she'd be in the audience with me. We were both altos. So we sang almost yearly the Messiah with the Lyric. And one year, she was getting older, and she said, "I can't sing this." And I said, "Mom, I said, why?" And she said, "Because my pitch that I'm hearing in my head is like a quarter tone off, and something's wrong. Either they're wrong or I'm wrong."
Yeah. Yeah.
Turns out that she was getting older, and as she got older, it slipped ever so slightly. And she finally said to me, I can't. I said, "Mom, don't look at the score.
Right.
Just see if you can, just don't look at the score. If you look at the score, you're going to break down in tears because you're not, it's not coming out the same."
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what about the other three in the quartet? Are they also beleaguered as such with perfect pitch?
I'm not sure they're as picky as I am, but the three brothers, I think we do have perfect pitch. I think my two brothers too. Yeah.
Yeah. Elizabeth? Yeah. And it's a blessing and a curse. Richard, you're about to say something.
I am. I also need to add an addendum to that lovely story you told about my query. Neil Cabaretti was asked that same question and certainly responded the same. However, he did say that on rare occasions, they would change the key of the music to accommodate the performer who was singing along. Very rarely, but it does happen. So on the one hand, it was a very interesting reaction by the first composer, but I felt only slightly vindicated. But again, well, I know that the composers, they write the music in the key in which they've chosen for a reason, whether we know what it is or not. So that's why I know it is so important to make sure that I don't screw around with the music when I'm producing something, whether it's pop music or classical music, because it was produced in that way. And I don't want to interfere with that creativity that they have put down. So that's my
Richard. Richard, but you had also another question from Maestro Cabaretti. First of all, a maestro said to you, I remember this, we more likely would do that in opera.
Yes.
Yeah. Remember that. Yeah. And the second thing he said to you, and you responded, and I'll never forget this either. You responded with almost 50 years of studio work as a sound engineer. Yeah. And you said, "I have to be really careful with those old-fashioned turntables because I could just, upset a musician terribly with a faulty turntable or a little bit slower, a little bit." And I don't know if you remember that, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I was actually producing transferring a 78 RPM record to the computer, but I didn't have a player. So I took a shot and I guess, and I said, "All right, let's try 45, and then what we'll do is we'll reduce the speed by 50%, and it worked. Now, if it was 100% accurate, I don't know. All I know is that it sounded a heck of a lot closer than it would have if I had tried something else, or I wish I'd had a 78. I would have loved to have tried that, but...
Yeah, so you need somebody like Saul to actually tell you one way or the other. Here's my last question, because I know Saul's got a... jump at 10:30 and say, there's this thing called synesthesia.
Oh, and
So synesthesia. Now, my mom also has that as well. So she'll hear, F sharp, and she'll see as a certain color. Mm-hmm. And she'll also see, believe it or not, Saul, she'll see a color and see a number.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I know some people have it. And I wonder if that's a real thing, if it can be measured, or is it a personal subjective experience? I think it's been documented. I don't have that. I do see colors, but they change. Like F major one day can be white, next day can be yellow, and so it's not fixed with me.
Yeah,
I
I
have
don't
it
know how that.
myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Do you?
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that. No, I've known you almost 20 years, and I never knew that.
You sound like my mother, who, after reading my book, said, "I learned things about you I did not know that I wanted to know."
Yeah.
Well, listen, I want to just do one more shout out as far as the performance is concerned. It's going to be Sunday, November 10th at 2 p.m. The Quarteto Latin Americano. It's a chamber music concert, which is at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art at the Mary Craig Auditorium at 2 p.m. And the quartet is going to play Hector Villa-Lobos. They're going to play Gershwin, Piazzolla, Four for Tango. Anybody that's listening that's a fan of tango in Santa Barbara, this is a rare opportunity because he only wrote one quartet, did Piazzolla. Playing Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, very, very famous moving piece, and they're playing Dvorak, American Symphony in F major, or sorry, quartet in F major. And thank you so much, Saul, for coming on and talking to us a little bit about your wonderful many, many years in career, 42 years as a quartet, and bringing Latin American music all over the world, all chamber music, I should say, quartet music all over the world.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Thank you, Richard, for hosting us. And I'm looking forward to our concert on November 10th.
Yeah, look forward to it too. Look forward to seeing you actually
Yeah.
in the role.
And during the
Thank
break, give
you.
me your phone number. I'll put you on my speed dial if I have questions.
Oh, come on, Richard. You're not going to call his cell phone in the middle of performance. Okay, so
Okay.
when we come back, we're going to be talking with my buddy Daniel Landsman, who is a big mover and shaker with the Lacumbre Center for the Arts. And we are celebrating 5 years. I remember covering them 5 years ago when they were first getting underway, thinking, I don't know if this is going to work or not. They've expanded their gallery to five galleries now. So obviously it's worked in Santa Barbara here. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, let the folks in from the waiting room and we'll go with Daniel. Welcome back, and this is Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm speaking with a couple of friends here. I didn't realize everybody was going to show up, but I have my friend Rod Roll here. Mike Cregan is here, the director of the Lacumbre Center for the Arts, and this is 5 years, Mike, from the day that I had you on first, and you described going to New York City and seeing this, and you wanted to bring this dream to Santa Barbara, and I thought, I don't know about this. And boy, it sure did work beautifully. Now you're what? Are you at five or seven spaces now?
Well, there are now six artistic spaces at actually seven, I think, at the moment, artistic spaces at La Cumbre. Yes.
So that's fantastic. And I congratulate you on 5 years. I have with us also Daniel Landman. And Daniel is an old friend of mine who is a wonderful sculptor. I have Angela Borda on as well, and Angela is with the group. And I guess let's talk with Rod. Rod is an internationally known photographer and based here in Santa Barbara. And if you saw some of his most iconic works, you would recognize his work in general. And Rod, you know, what do you do with the center?
I'm one of the artists at Elevate Gallery, and currently I have a relatively new exhibition there called Great Sale of the Navajo Nation, Monument Valley. And I had a chance to visit Monument Valley back in April of this year and spent a few days there. And it was really a great experience, a great revelation, you know, meeting members of the Navajo Nation. And it was a great inspiration. So it was my thoughts to capture the environment as best I could. And I'm happy with the results, and they're up at Elevate Gallery, and I hope everybody gets a chance to come by there and see for themselves.
Now, as far as the Elevate, now, are you showing, or are you also offering limited edition prints?
I'm showing and offering limited edition prints.
Okay.
Yeah, so feel free to go by, take a look, and they can find that information there right by the exhibition. And
okay. And so you were at the in the Navajo Nation in April of this year?
Yeah.
And yeah, so are you shooting mainly landscapes or people or all of the above?
Well, this one was landscapes, because it was my first side trip. I was driving across country, and a friend of mine suggested I go to Grand Canyon. And when I saw how close it was from, Monument Valley was to where I was, staying at the time I was in Flagstaff, I decided to go to Monument Valley because that's the place I had always wanted to visit. And I said, this is an opportunity to go. And I drove to Monument Valley. Like I said, spent two nights there and then continued on my trip to North Carolina.
Oh, okay. So you were going home for a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's at Elevate. Angela, where are you? What gallery are you?
I share a gallery space with Rod and all the other artists at Elevate Gallery.
You're at Elevate. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. What are you doing there right now?
I'm a painter. Primarily, I'm also the editor of the Santa Barbara Literary Journal, but I am painting what I fondly call naked blue fairies in space is what I'm working on right now.
You say that again?
Naked blue fairies in space is what I've been painting recently. That's the funny name for them. They're fairies. They're celestial creatures kind of with a starscape behind them. It's all blues and stars and kind of that color range.
I knew your name was familiar. Yeah, we've spoken in regards to the Literary Journal as well. Yeah, now I know who you are. Of course, Angela.
Well, yeah. I'm also known as Silver Web, so that's my pen name.
Right. And I think you, the journal, aren't there two of you, or maybe on the journal, are you the main editor in practice?
I am indeed. I'm the founder and I'm the editrix, but that's just writing and publishing. My role at the gallery is strictly art.
Yeah, right. Okay. So I think I knew you were also I think a poet as well. Is that correct? Yeah. Yeah. No,
no,
not a poet.
No poetry that's fit to print, but I can write you some if you want.
And so Richard's giving us a sign we have to go to quick break, but then I also want to find out what Daniel's doing lately. And so let's go to quick break and then let's get back with Daniel.
All right.
Okay, Richard. Yeah. Are we off?
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's celebration of La Cumbre Center for the Arts and all of the galleries there that have expanded into a marvelous, marvelous place under the direction of Mike Cregan. Daniel brought this to my attention. And Daniel, what gallery are you with?
I manage the Fine Line Gallery in the mall.
Okay. So here's a question. So you manage Fine Line, there's Elevate. What are the other galleries' names?
There's Illuminations, Elevate, and Fine Line.
Okay.
And then there's also the Voice Gallery.
Yeah.
The Arts Fund Gallery, the Grace Fisher Gallery, and now also the Crimson Gallery is open.
That's marvelous.
Yes.
Just marvelous. So of the three galleries that Daniel, that you're mentioning, what personality do each of those three have?
Each one has its own flavor and setup. You know, our gallery, we tend to have a more studio space. So we have our gallery space and then we have our studio space, and we're usually always there working as well. Where the other galleries will have maybe half studio space and more display space. And each gallery, we try to carry a good mix of people where, you know, we have photography at our place, but, you know, it doesn't pull away from the other galleries as well. So we try to collaborate, like who's showing and how we work together.
And so that's, but what I'm interested to know the flavor of the other two galleries is as you could perceive it.
Oh, how I perceive it?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, geez, that's a good question. I've never even thought about that. I'm used to talking to about our own flavor. So I feel like the others, we just all kind of complement one another. In a way, so we have, we have one side that we have our elders, and then we have the younger people that bring in the young vibe, and I feel like we're dispersed around pretty evenly on that, but we're all kind of members of the community, so I don't know. I guess Elevate would be more photography and fairy based and imaginative work, where Illuminations, it's based on sculpture and drawing and color works, so maybe it's more ethereal, and then we're the blue collar worker gallery at the Fine Line.
Now, Mike, do you agree with that characterization?
Yes, basically. Each one is very unique. And I would say maybe that in certain ways, Elevate has a little more abstract element to it. And the Illuminations Gallery is probably a bit more three-dimensional with various different sculptors in there. And then again, Fine Line, as he says, is a lot of half the gallery is studios. So the artists work at each one, and each one of them has a different style of painting. So it's a variety, but complements each other.
So as the founder of this wonderful venture, I don't know if you'll be able to answer this at the drop of the hat, but can you recall your happiest moment as director?
I would say probably was in a certain, there've been a number of them, but one of them that I particularly remember is toward the beginning when we first started and we're getting things going. The artists were excited about getting going, but many of them had real reservations, like, gosh, you know, I'm such an individual person, an independent person. how am I going to get along with these other people? And how is that going to work? And so forth. And many of them were very worried about that and working in close proximity with, you know, seven other artists. But then the real moment is what you're saying, Joy, was about a month later when they started coming up to me and saying, oh, God, this is like my family. this is wonderful being part of this and very different than I ever expected. And I think that was really, that's something that I always remember, is having a number of them come up to me and say that exact thing.
The feeling, the camaraderie, in other words.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They were all friends. They were like a family. And they were just happier than they ever could have expected being part of that artistic group.
And Angela, I've got a question for you as a painter. Let's say somebody's coming into the gallery and they're looking at a work that you've done and they're interested in purchasing it. How do you talk about your own work?
Well, that's a good question. People who come in generally want to kind of know the process of how the work came to be, what inspired it, and kind of the story within each painting. And people are really curious, not just to hear about mine, but we walk through the gallery and talk about everybody's art and the stories inherent in them. So it's storytelling with visual aids.
Yeah. 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 And let's say people want to buy. Have you sold to people that are out of town?
We have a fair number of people who come, who are just stopping by on their road trips, actually. And I don't know the exact location of the people who have bought our paintings there, but we have a good mix of people who are stopping by, who are tourists, and people who know about La Cumbre, our association, and stop by regularly because they want to see what's new. People are coming. Right. People are coming in to see Rod's exhibition because they know it's new, and we all love his work. So, it's a good mix of customers, I would say.
Rod, how do you approach a buyer? In other words, what do you say? Someone's interested in purchasing. Yeah, how do you approach a buyer?
Oh, for me or Angela?
You, right.
Oh. Well, you know, on this exhibit, I'm trying something new. I've made metal prints. So I have fine art prints, and I have metal prints that are printed on aluminum. And this is the first for me. The metal prints are... I tried to tell them about the luminance properties of the metal prints. So as the print is lit, it brings out different qualities of the print. So, and when I saw it demonstrated on YouTube, the artist had a dimmer. So as he dimmed the light, different properties of the print came out. And then as he brightened the light, you can see different things in the print as well. So I think that's a very nice quality. It's almost kind of a magical quality to the print. It just comes alive just as the light changes in the room. So I try to, you know, just talk to that about the prints when people are interested in them.
Is it lit in the gallery in the way that you're describing?
It's lit, yeah, but you would have to walk around. They can't dim the lights and what have you. I just had an opening last Friday, and what I did is I had a flashlight, and as I moved flashlight across the print, people could see different qualities. And actually, I was surprised afterwards, after the demonstration, people were saying, wow, you know, they saw different things in the print. Even I didn't realize, but they were, you know, looking at following the light as I was moving it across the print, and they were seeing different qualities in the clouds and in the backgrounds and everything. So,
and I just have to say, Daniel, what are you working on now?
I'm currently finishing up a Divine Feminine series, which I've been working on for the last 3.5 years. And,
give me the title again.
Divine Feminine.
Divine Feminine. Okay.
Yeah. So I wanted to end the series at the Three Graces. So I just finished up those three sculptures, and I'm going to put the series to rest.
Excellent. Well, congratulations, everybody, on your 5th anniversary, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.